Beyond the miracles of modern medicine, the body has an amazing capacity to heal itself. In this volume of this series, Dr. Chopra discusses the Ayurvedic method of focusing your energies on disease prevention, dealing with disease before it has a chance to manifest itself in the body. He discusses coronary heart disease in detail, its causes, and the preventative measures that you can take to greatly improve the condition of your heart. Along the same vein, he discusses the secrets of longevity and how much your attitude can determine your actual biological age. The unification of body, mind, and spirit is emphasized as one of the major contributing factors to whole health. Following the ancient traditions of Ayurveda, Dr. Chopra takes you on a fascinating journey in which sound is used as a powerful healing vehicle. To conclude, he provides you with several simple yet very effective exercises on strengthening your eyes, the mirrors to your soul.
At every stage of spiritual growth, the greatest ally you have is your body. Does this statement sound surprising? Most of us tend to assume that body and spirit stand at opposite ends of the spectrum. When we feel sensations that are body-centered, such as hunger and thirst, pain and pleasure, or even happiness and sadness, we do not think of these as spiritual experiences. Sensuousness, which encompasses the whole range of physical delight, is often considered low compared to the heights of the soul. But spirituality is sensuous, because a spiritual person is someone who lives fully in the present moment, which means living fully in the body. As you cross from ordinary waking state to higher states of awareness, the body serves as your vehicle. It is not a leaky boat you hope will get you there before you sink it. No, if you are truly in tune with your body, it becomes a trusted teacher and a trusted guide. In order to trust your body as a guide, the first step is to begin to understand it. The human body, and particularly the brain and central nervous system, functions as a two-way antenna monitoring the reality out there, but also reality in here. From moment to moment, each of us receives a steady flow of information that enters through the five senses, gets processed by the mind, and is eventually converted into the body. I see an apple pie, I feel hungry, and I take a slice. In that simple act, I'm processing a piece of the world into myself. But you can also reverse the flow. When the body has a need, it tells the mind, which goes and looks for a source of fulfillment. For example, if my kidneys detect a fluid shortage in the bloodstream, they secrete a hormone, a specific chemical messenger, which reaches the brain and is converted into a mental event. I feel thirsty. See this intimate connection? Back and forth these messages go, from body to mind, from mind to body, creating the balanced flow of life. They form a circle of constantly changing desires, a river that is in me, that is me. As spiritual unfoldment becomes conscious, the circle of life acquires another dimension. Your sense of self expands with no end in sight. More and more experience is allowed to come into the never-ending conversation that each of us is conducting with all 50 trillion cells in our body. Unfortunately, our culture has made the mistake of deciding that the human body is a machine, an inert lump of matter that mechanically obeys the mind without any intelligence of its own. This misconception led to a second mistake, the idea that the most spiritual people must be those who renounce the body, denigrate its passions, or at the very least attempt to control its desires. This kind of prejudice against the body runs contrary to the very way that nature fashioned us. Nature balanced mind, body, and spirit as co-creators of our personal reality. You cannot do a single thing, from falling in love to uttering a prayer to metabolizing a molecule of sugar, without affecting everything that you are. The body is the platform which allows any experience to emerge and see the light of day. It is a three-dimensional projection of billions of separate processes going on at any moment, including a process as profound as coming to know the reality of God. It may seem totally self-evident to you that your body is basically a physical entity, but that is really a judgment on your part. Granted, it is a judgment shared by millions of people in the scientific age. For example, science tells us that the heart is a pump, an incredibly reliable machine, but one that is liable to mechanical failure at any moment. But you could just as easily claim that the heart is not this tough bundle of twitching muscles. It is the invisible organizing power that creates a very specific organ out of the same atoms and molecules that are found in every life form. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen are the atomic soup that exists in everything alive, from a butterfly wing to a quivering amoeba to a parrot's beak. Inside you, the same building materials could have turned into a stomach or a liver cell instead of a heart cell, except for the unseen intelligence that organized them just this way. That unseen intelligence is yours to command. It flows everywhere in your body, and in fact, every feeling and emotion you have is changing the flow by either a small or a great amount. The whole idea that the heart is a machine is just an image created in our minds, a metaphor we project onto a much richer reality. If you are not spellbound by the metaphor, it is self-evident that the heart is not a pump. It grows, for one thing. At birth, our hearts weighed less than 2 ounces and took more than a decade to reach their final weight of just over a pound. The heart can also alter its own rhythm and stroke volume, self-regulate its timing, sense changes in its environment, and repair damage inflicted by minor heart attacks. What pump does any of that? Then there are feelings associated with my heart. Something in my chest aches with pain, soars with joy, turns hard as flint when it feels distrust, and melts as softly with tenderness as a snowflake in the sun. These are not mere intangibles of emotion. They lead to millions of chemical changes affecting the whole physiology. A depressed person literally has depressed cells. A happy person has happy ones. The difference between the two can be broken down into minute changes of chemical balance, and without these chemicals, you could not be depressed or be happy. You could not have an emotion of any kind. In a very real sense, to be alive is a multi-dimensional act, because so much is happening on so many different levels. They are all levels of one intelligence. In a single moment of life, this intelligence is thinking, feeling, perceiving, breathing, digesting. It is taking in trillions of molecules of food and air and turning them into that mysteriously unique creation called you. At the most subtle level, your inner intelligence is also steadily progressing along the corridors of eternity, although that process is more deeply hidden than the others. Underlying all this bewildering complex activity is one theme, the constant expression of your own needs and desires. Being in touch with your needs is the most powerful way to be in touch with where your inner intelligence is heading at this very moment. This attentiveness makes you a conscious person, someone who is growing and evolving along lines no one else will exactly duplicate, not even the greatest of masters. In Emerson's famous phrase, you are here to enjoy an original relationship to the universe. To be in touch with yourself requires great sensitivity to everything that's going on here and now. The spiritual needs we all have for love, compassion, meaningfulness, total acceptance, devotion, and inner peace are not grand goals to be achieved in a distant time and place. They exist here and now. Spiritual input does not come from another dimension. Your own desires are just manifesting on a subtler level. compassion is subtler than vitamin C, but both are real needs. And just as the body knows how to process vitamin C and send it where it is required, the inner intelligence of every cell has a profound knowledge of where to find spiritual sustenance and how to use it. Whatever your past conditioning says, your body knows a spiritual deficiency when it feels one. This is because the body wants to be in balance. That is its most profound instinct. Any imbalance can be traced to a state of lack. To live without love, devotion, compassion, or any other spiritual value creates a state of such severe imbalance that every cell yearns to correct it. Ultimately, that is what lies behind the onset of disease. The body is sending a message that some lack is present. An imbalance existing somewhere in inner space that you cannot see or touch has given rise to highly visible, unarguably physical symptoms. Sickness and disease is a change in awareness from comfort to discomfort. Awareness has deviated from its self-referral path of happiness, from its self-referral path of bliss. And that is usually due to a frustrated impulse of intelligence, a frustrated desire that cannot be easily fulfilled or accomplished and gets locked somewhere in your quantum mechanical body, changing that experience of the body from comfort to discomfort, dis-ease. Sickness, therefore, is a self-correcting, cybernetic feedback mechanism to allow you to get on the path of bliss, happiness, and the spontaneous fulfillment of all your desires. In order to prevent disease at the most profound level, one does not have to go to any great lengths. The key is to allow your awareness to be present with the body and pay attention to its signals. A gentle focus of attention is all it takes to free the body of minor imbalances. If you are able, shut your eyes right now and sit quietly. What do you notice? Without effort on your part, you'll begin to sense some physical sensation. A twinge in a sore joint, aching in your feet, tight neck muscles. Any source of discomfort acts as a signal of imbalance, and your natural response is to pay attention. Ignoring pain and discomfort imposes a strain because it takes effort to keep your awareness from going where it wants to. Why do we ignore the body's signals? Fear is the most basic reason. A minor pain makes us afraid because we jump to horrible conclusions. And in that instant of fear, as we cringe and draw back, we are letting fear deprive us of a natural response to something the body is trying to say. Where is this minor discomfort actually heading? We never find out because we have all been indoctrinated to feel massive distrust of the body. We automatically identify it with pain and suffering. Yet, if we stand back and ignore all that old conditioning, it becomes clear that pain is not the same as suffering. Suffering is a mental event, an interpretation we put upon the signal of pain. In and of itself, pain is neutral. A marathon runner does not consider the pain in his chest, however painful it becomes, a form of suffering. While a post-operative patient who has just received a bypass graft may be terrified of chest pain, which is even much milder. In labor, a mother willingly goes through pain without identifying it with suffering. Quite the contrary, she will most likely identify it with the joy of childbirth, and that gives her the strength to accept the pain without judgment. Learning to untangle pain from suffering is only the beginning. Once you realize that you have control over any interpretation you place on your body, an enormously liberating idea begins to dawn. The body is on your side. Its signals are messages from a friend, and far from being threatening, these signals are either asking for help or offering it. Shut your eyes again and allow your awareness to wander where it will. The sensations that you start to feel, let's say it's coming from a tight neck muscle, are asking for healing. The fact that you are paying attention to a sensation is what brings the healing. The mind is answering the body's request. That famous phrase, the inner healer is nothing but this, the natural response of your inner intelligence to a request for help. A friend to a friend, one part of you is joining with another in compassion. Yet there is more than compassion at work, for the act of paying attention contains tremendous power. Think of a crying child who turns peaceful and happy as soon as its mother pays attention to it. The same response occurs in the body. Any cell, tissue, or organ is capable of crying for attention, and when you give it some, the healing process begins. Our society has ignored this fundamental process and paid a high price for it. We have created an overwhelmingly wasteful, expensive, frightening, and inhuman medical system based on the myth that healing belongs in the hands of professionals. We have ignored our own power to heal, becoming blind to the subtle signals of discomfort and imbalance inside our bodies, so that we finally have no choice but to take the advanced cancer or the blocked coronary artery to a specialist. So this morning we're going to talk about heart disease, and heart disease, as you know, when I am talking about heart disease, I'm talking now of coronary artery disease and not rheumatic heart disease and not congenital heart disease. There's so many kinds of heart disease, but the one that is really the number one killer of our civilization, the epidemic of our culture, is coronary artery disease, a condition where there is progressive narrowing of the coronary blood vessels, ultimately leading to a myocardial infarction, which means death of the muscle of the heart and leading ultimately to death. This is the number one problem of our civilization. The other significant problems of our civilization are automobile accidents, addictions, cancer, and now AIDS. But if you combine all of them, this still exceeds everything else. So this is indeed the number one killer in our civilization. Approximately 1.5 million Americans will have myocardial infarction this year, of which 500,000 will die, and at least 300,000 people in the United States will have a coronary bypass graft operation, which these days costs anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000. So you can see the huge impact of this disease on our society. When I was in medical school, we were taught that these were the conventional risk factors for coronary artery disease. And if you ask the American Heart Association, even today they will say that these are the risk factors: smoking, hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes, obesity, and a family history of coronary artery disease. And yet, the data shows otherwise. This is what is taught to us in medical schools, and even is the official statement of the American Heart Association. But the data that is emerging right now says that actually more than 60% of patients who will die of a heart attack before the age of 65, which means the majority of people who will die of a heart attack before the age of 65, actually do not have any of these risk factors. So despite the fact that these indeed are risk factors, the perplexing data still is that the majority of people who are dying of heart attacks do not have any of the standard risk factors for heart disease. So what's going on? In fact, when this kind of data started to emerge, there was an attempt, starting in Framingham, Massachusetts, which is where I took my training in that Massachusetts area, and this was a big thing. You know, about 15-20 years ago,
there was an attempt to decrease the risk factors of heart disease through intervention. You take people and you make them stop smoking, you make them lose weight, you regulate their blood pressure, you bring down their cholesterol levels, and then what you expect is that they will have a lower incidence of heart disease. Because, obviously, if you're cutting down the risk factors, then you should have a lower incidence of heart disease, you should have a lower incidence of heart attacks and mortality. Well, this was a very famous study done in Massachusetts 15 years ago, where intervention showed minimal reduction in heart disease and overall increase in mortality in those people who had intervention of risk factors. A more recent study was done in Sweden, where people with high risk factors underwent intervention, particularly things that we think we can control: smoking, hypertension, high cholesterol, obesity, change their eating habits, were introduced to an exercise program, etc. And the mortality was significantly higher in those people who had intervention of risk factors. And this study was published in the British Medical Journal about 5-6 years ago, and the editor said that probably the hassle factor or the stress that was induced in these people as a result of wanting to change the risk factors was responsible for the even higher mortality in those people who had these interventions. Now, having said that, there's no doubt that there are other studies that show if you use effective methods to, say, decrease cholesterol, that does alter the incidence of heart disease. But overall, the results of intervention in coronary artery disease prevention programs have been extremely disappointing. And my feeling when I look at this data is that all the interventions are motivated by fear. Patients are told that if you don't stop smoking, you're definitely going to get a heart attack or cancer or something else. They're told that you've got to lower that cholesterol. In fact, if you go around airports in this country, which I do a lot, you see all these big posters from the American Heart Association that says, "Have you checked your cholesterol today?" Okay. And, you know, that's pretty scary. So everybody's being motivated by fear, and the fear itself has its own biological response. So one of the things that we have not really grasped fully in medicine, even in the prevention programs, is that motivation by fear may in fact exacerbate the problem, whatever that problem is, whether it's heart disease or anything else. If on the other hand, your motivation comes out of inspiration, which is different than motivation. In fact, the word inspiration literally means to be in spirit. Then the change of behavior comes out of the experience of joy. Joy becomes the motivating factor. And then, of course, the strategy will work very effectively. Fear-based strategies do not work. Whether they are in hypertension or cholesterol, that's been proven over and over again. Athletes or people who run every day because they think it's good for them, not because they enjoy it, are likely to drop dead on the track. And this is true of any kind of behavior that we want to change. So behavioral modification programs in general have been extremely disappointing because the fear generates its own physiology. So what's the solution? The solution is to look again at what are the psychological factors that influence behavior. After all, if you have obesity, if you're smoking, if you have addictive behavior, it's probably a substitute for something that you're seeking, you just don't know how to find it. My experience with patients with addiction has always reinforced my feeling that addiction and addictive behaviors in general are a second-class substitute for the loss of exaltation. The exaltation and the joy that comes from the experience of the Spirit. And human behavior in general is motivated only by two things. And I'm saying in general, because most people, unless they're in love or unless they have a predisposition to spiritual seeking, are not aware of that. So in general, human behavior is motivated by two things: the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. And you'll see that's what most human beings are doing all the time. We're either avoiding pain or we are pursuing pleasure. And sometimes our first experience of pleasure is through substance use, whether it's cigarettes or alcohol or drugs or sex or any other experience that gives us a temporary high. And the human nervous system is such that it associates that experience, even if once, with intense pleasure, then it gets hooked, you might say, to the memory of that experience. And so addiction is really addiction to a memory, always. It's not to the substance, it's to the memory. And long after the stimulus has ceased to be pleasurable, the physical body, and the cells of the physical body, the nervous system, are still hooked to the memory. The body is the incarnation of memory. There is no way you can erase that memory. So theoretically, you cannot get rid of addictive behavior by trying to get rid of the memory of pleasure. You might have stopped smoking for 20 years or stopped drinking for 20 years if you have a problem with alcoholism, but that memory will never go away. And there was always the chance that, given the right neuro-associative conditioning, go right back to it. Because it's in your cells. You cannot erase memories from the cells. So what's the solution if you can't erase memories? The only solution is to create a new memory which is more powerful than the old memory. The old memory is never lost. It is overshadowed by the new memory. When you introduce the new experience, the new karmic episode, it must be of such power and of such pleasurable significance to you that it has to overshadow the old memory. It's less important, even though that old memory never goes away. And therefore, the Ayurvedic approaches to addictive behaviors are basically to reintroduce the whole idea that we live in a sensuous and sensual universe, and that the experience of pure spirit is exaltation. Exaltation or ecstasy is the primary experience of life. It's the original primordial energy state. In fact, the word ecstasy comes from the word ektasis, which means to step out of space-time into the experience of unity consciousness, or what's called a peak experience, or pure joy, exaltation of spirit. They all mean the same thing. So all the strategies are, of course, elimination of toxins, but also through sensory stimulation, through sensory modulation, through the five senses, to enhance the experience of pleasure, to reinterpret the experience of pleasure, and ultimately to give us the experience of pure spirit or higher states of consciousness. Since we are on the topic of ecstasy, I'm just going to say a little bit about it. There are three kinds of ecstasy. The first kind is physical ecstasy. And physical ecstasy comes from physical experience, which is sensory. It comes through sound, through touch, through sight, through taste, through smell. And we do live in a sensuous universe, and when God decided to create the universe, the Vedic concept is, she had this idea, we must make it a lot of fun. And therefore, sensory gratification is really an important thing. As long as it's done with pure awareness, it's done with attention, it's done with present moment, life-centered awareness, then you have a chance of really experiencing the exquisite exaltation that comes from being touched or being loved or making love or eating or anything that has anything to do with the senses. The second kind of ecstasy is what is called mythical or archetypal ecstasy. And this is a very interesting notion only introduced in this century by Carl Jung, the great psychologist, but actually a concept that is very, very much part of all traditional cultures. The word mythical, myth, mythology, there are two roots to that word. Myth is related again to the word mother, which refers to the womb of creation. Logos, of course, is knowledge. So mythology is the knowledge of creation. And Joseph Campbell, who was one of the modern authorities on mythology, said that mythology is truer than history. History is just another form of journalism, and we know how reliable that is. But mythology really captures the true essence of the consciousness of a collective soul. So beneath the level of our conscious awareness, our unconscious motivations dwell in the mythical world, which means that deep inside us, in our consciousness, in our psyche, there are gods and goddesses in embryo, and they yearn to be born, they yearn to lift us out of the ordinary, the humdrum, the trivial, the mundane level of existence. That we know this without knowing it, in that we act out our unconscious or mythical motivations, sometimes even without bringing them into our conscious awareness. Something as mundane or as banal as striving to succeed in a corporate takeover bid actually partakes of the heroic journey as much as the Argonaut seeking the golden fleece. Climbing Mount Everest is driven by the same ambition to reach the abode of gods as Icarus flying toward the sun. So, in mythical terms, ecstasy is a sacred journey that we undertake into the underworld, into the subconscious. And when we lose that mythology as part of our bankrupt culture, then we lose the experience of ecstasy. And that's why kids will join gangs, because gangs have mythology, gangs have ritual, gangs have initiation, gangs have leadership, gangs have imagination. It takes us as much imagination to be a gang leader as it takes to be Krishna or to be Ulysses or to be Rama or to be Achilles. So we need to really start bringing ritual into our life. We now need to start bringing initiations, rites of passage, the traditional things that made life so mysterious, enchanting, and ecstatic. And the third type of ecstasy is what I've already referred to, exaltation of spirit, or spiritual ecstasy, or sacred ecstasy, or divine ecstasy, which is the experience of God, which is the experience of the divine within us and higher states of consciousness. You know, in the Book of Solomon, which goes back to the birth of Judeo-Christianity, there's a beautiful ode by Solomon that, in a sense, describes all these three kinds of ecstasies. In one of his songs, Solomon says, "He split me and tore my heart open and filled me with love. You poured your spirit into mine. I knew you as I know myself. My eyes are radiant with your light. My nostrils are filled with your fragrance. My ears delight in your music. And my face is covered with your dew." So much sensuousness. And it says, "You have made me see all things shining. You have made me see all things new. I know you as I know myself. Now that's a pretty good description of the different kinds of ecstasy that we have access to. And it's part of every tradition, as you can see.
Although everyone has occasions for grief, shock, sadness, and disappointment, some of us spring back much better than others. Dunbar went on to compile 6 traits that, in her opinion, were shared by pre-centenarians, people who have the best chance of living to be 100. At the top of the list was an ability to respond creatively to change. More than any other, this trait made pre-centenarians stand out from ordinary people. Second in importance was freedom from anxiety. Anxiety is a great enemy of the pair of traits which were third on Professor Dunbar's list, the ability to improvise and create. High levels of adaptive energy were in fourth place. The fifth trait was a capacity to integrate new things into one's life. And finally, although perhaps this should have come first, there was simply wanting to stay alive. As with all predictive models, this one is flawed. It can't be denied that some people simply vegetate and still live to be 100, as do some who are rigid and uncreative, and even a certain number of individuals who couldn't care less whether they live or die. But positive qualities are far more common in centenarians, and as a description of the kind of old age that is most desirable, Dunbar's list is extremely helpful. Her pre-centenarians are special because they reveal that just as people have strong or weak immune systems, we all vary in how well we adapt mentally. For some people, the journey of life, however harsh on the outside, is met with resilience instead of brittleness. They are the trees who bend with the storm, not the ones that stand stiff and break. Adaptability can be most simply defined as freedom from conditioned response, to remain open to change, to accept the new and welcome the unknown is a choice that involves definite personal skills. For left to inertia, the mind tends to reinforce its old habits and increasingly to fall prey to its conditioning. In your guidebook, you'll find an adaptability questionnaire to help you assess your skills for reaching accommodation with life's twists and turns. The purpose of this test is not to make anyone feel superior or inferior, but to spur conscious growth. The common denominator of all adaptable people is that they actually work on a daily basis at keeping their awareness open. This tape series is devoted to that work, and I feel that there is no higher life purpose than trying to open your awareness until the full impact of reality in all its beauty, truth, and sacredness and wonder is consciously experienced. Reduced awareness occurs when life is not consciously lived and appreciated. This tendency is often so subtle that it may take months or years before the damaging results are evident, but the trail of clues is very obvious for anyone who cares to look. The age changes that develop in body and mind are the end products of thoughtlessly giving in to rigid assumptions, beliefs, and opinions. Some people, for instance, have absorbed the notion that they are going to lose their memory in old age, an expectation frequently reinforced by those who believe in the old age. As soon as they are 55 or 60, such people begin to worry about every little tiny memory lapse, despite the fact that occasional memory lapses occur to everyone, young and old. Memory is a funny thing. You can't make yourself remember anything, but you can make yourself forget. One way to do this is to block a memory with anxiety. Remember that last time you were in an emergency and had to call home? You rushed to a payphone in a state of anxiety, and as you picked up the receiver, the thought flashed through your mind, "What's my number? I've forgotten my number." This thought doesn't go away until you calm down and allow the fog of anxiety to withdraw, which then permits memory to arise spontaneously. Some people are so anxious about growing old that they cannot help but leak that anxiety into every situation that calls for them to remember something. A friend's name, someone's address, the place where they left their keys. They start trying to monitor their memory. They think, okay, am I about to forget this? Which only makes matters worse, until they get caught up in a vicious circle. They are so persuaded of encroaching senility that they force themselves into memory loss by not allowing enough relaxation for memory to work. The development of any character trait starts early in life and begins to display itself by middle age. The best way to ensure that you will be adaptable in old age is to work on being that way when you are still young. This was demonstrated in a classic study started 50 years ago by Harvard psychologist George Vaillant. He took 185 young men, students at Harvard during World War II, and monitored their health for almost 40 years. Vaillant found that even if someone appeared perfectly healthy in youth, he was very likely to die prematurely if he reacted poorly to stress, fell prey to depression, or was psychologically unstable. Of the men who had the best mental health, only 2 became chronically ill or died by age 53. Of the 48 men with the poorest mental health, however, 18, almost 10 times as many, were chronically ill or dead by that age. Vaillant concluded that early aging, defined as irreversible physical decline, was retarded by good mental health and accelerated by poor mental health. The most formative years for establishing these conditions, he found, were between ages 21 and 46, because those are the years when a person generally succeeds or fails in establishing a secure sense of self, regardless of even the most terrible childhood traumas and abuse. Once the seed is planted, the results of mental health show up physically in one's 50s. Late middle age is the perilous decade, often called the danger zone, because it is then that premature heart attacks, runaway hypertension, and many types of cancer first show up in great number. To put it more generally, Vaillant found that the aging process is learned. People with good mental health teach their bodies to age well. Depressed, insecure, and unhappy people teach their bodies to age badly. Although Vaillant observed that increased stress was often found in the lives of those who became chronically ill and died young, he had the insight to realize that stress doesn't make people sick. Giving up their inner adaptability to stress does. The greatest threat to life and health is having nothing to live for. Children display tremendous vitality and rush at each day with open arms. This is natural to them and remains natural unless they learn the dulling habits and attitudes that smother spontaneous curiosity and wonder. Vaillant was among the first researchers to establish that being depressed often leads to premature aging, chronic illness, and early death. Generally, at the root of depression is a kind of emotional numbness. The person feels he has no laughter or joy inside because these positive emotions have been blocked by unhappy memories. Old traumas lurk inside, and when new feelings try to bubble up, they are filtered through the traumas. Even the most beautiful experience, such as having a baby, cannot survive if it has to be filtered through pre-existing hopelessness. Giving birth generates a flood of powerful hormones, generating a surge of energy pouring through the body. In a woman with healthy memories of her early childhood, this surging energy is experienced
as a strong bond to her child. And at the same time, the body renews its energy after the exhaustion of going into labor. Within a few days, the whole mind-body system has been returned to express the joy and power of motherhood. However, in a woman whose memories associated early childhood with sadness and emotional hurt, the flood of new energy during childbirth triggers the old programming instead. The joy and power are transformed into apathy and fatigue. Postpartum depression is the result of outworn memories seizing a new lease on life. Although the vast majority of depressed people are treated with antidepressant drugs, such medications do not cure the underlying sadness, trauma, and numbness that are the true cause of the disorder. When the drug is taken away, the depression flowers again. Even though it takes longer and requires more insight and courage, a more effective way to treat depression is through psychotherapy. Classic couch psychiatry is often scorned, but counseling a depressed patient, uncovering the inner hurt and releasing it, sometimes accomplishes a lasting cure, which no drug can claim. This implies that premature aging, which Vaillant so closely linked to depression and mental instability, might also be treatable in a similar way. In fact, all of us are learning and unlearning to age. We just haven't looked at ourselves in that way. While I was working on this section of Ageless Body, Timeless Mind, my family received a visit from my wife's uncle Prem, who flew in from New Delhi. Prem uncle, as he would be called in India, is very dear to us. Now 75 and retired from his corporate job, he bounds up and down the stairs with much more agility than I do. Prem uncle was a star tennis player in his youth, and he still plays every day. Simple in his pleasures and satisfied with his lot, he looks on life with enviable serenity and happiness. I set aside my reference books and asked him how he kept so young, and this is what Prem uncle replied. "Well, you know, I never pushed to extremes. I was just born that way. I never got in the habit of overeating. This morning I had a banana and cereal, and that is about as much as I ever want. I eat lightly at night and never drink more than a little brandy once in a while. Second, I sleep very well. That's due to my diet, because if I eat a big dinner, my sleep is disturbed. And third, I don't bother about trivialities. I leave that to my wife. He laughs. You know whose birthday it is and when we are due someplace, etc., etc. Fourth, I play tennis and I love it." Prem uncle is living proof of his method. But more important, he doesn't really have a method. The way he has aged is just the result of who he is. Someone else with utterly different habits, but the same easy acceptance of himself, would age just as well. In our society, we pick up hundreds of external cues about how to live, yet experience teaches us over and over that internal cues are the ones we must heed. Prem uncle did not derive his lifestyle from an outside authority. He evolved a moderate, sane, healthful way of life on his own. Most people who age successfully do the same. They follow their instincts, finding out what works for them. The fact that successful survival is so individual is not an incidental factor. On the contrary, it is among the most important. For in a society where we were automatically trained to look to outside authority for expert advice, where inner cues from our bodies are drowned out by a flood of external directives, the isolated individual who beats the system is a rarity. Social scientists have set out to take the measure of such people, and the results disclose some striking similarities. In 1973, at a gerontology conference at Duke University, three studies were presented describing the type of person who can expect to live to a healthy old age between 85 and 100 years old. Such people amount to less than 5% of the current population. In her research at the University of Chicago, psychologist Bernice Newgarten concentrated on life satisfaction, which entails five factors. First, people who enjoy life satisfaction derive pleasure from daily activities. Second, such people regard their lives as inherently meaningful. Third, they feel they've achieved their major goals. Fourth, they have a positive self-image and regard themselves as worthwhile. Fifth, they are fundamentally optimistic individuals. From his research at Harvard, psychologist George Villon took a second but similar perspective, as we have seen, that of mental health. The longest-lived individuals, he believed, are also the best adapted in their psychological life, a state characterized by a stable family life, marriages they regard as satisfying, rarely living alone, continuous growth in their careers, and no disabling mental illness or physical illness or alcoholism. The third perspective came from Eric Pfeiffer, a psychiatrist at Duke University and the project director of a long-term study on older Americans. Pfeiffer pointed out that using one's physical and mental abilities to the fullest was the best way to age well. People who aged successfully, he found, were those who stayed in training throughout their adult lives in three major areas: physical activity, psychological and intellectual activity, and social relationships. If we translate all these findings into larger terms, a profile emerges of people who age well psychologically and therefore biologically. Because so much of our internal programming is unconscious, we miss the fact that the most powerful influence we have over how we age comes simply from our awareness. To gain control over the aging process, you must first be aware of it. Awareness is the first all-important step toward positive change, and no animal besides man is consciously aware of aging. For most of us, the day comes when something jogs our awareness to tell us that we don't feel as vigorous or as strong or as sexually attractive as we once did. Be aware, however, that these distressing moments aren't aging. It's the absence of being aware when we don't see anything happening. It's then that physiological processes slip out of our control. As soon as you pay attention to any function, a transformation takes place. For example, if someone puts a 5-pound weight in your hand and lifts it up and down for you 100 times, your arm won't gain any muscle strength. However, if you perform the same action voluntarily, completely different signals are sent from the motor cortex in your brain. Not just your biceps, but your heart and lung tissues will receive increased stimulus, as will specific areas of your brain that control motor coordination. The activity of having your arm passively moved is analogous to unconscious, unwilled behavior. The activity of exercising represents conscious, willed behavior. The second mode of activity engages the intricate process called learning, which is at the root of growing, as opposed to growing old. Every time you consciously exercise your bicep, you're teaching it to be stronger, and your whole body, your brain, lungs, heart, endocrine glands, even your immune system, are adapting to a new mode of functioning. Conversely, if you move your body without awareness, passivity takes the place of learning. Biceps, heart, lungs, endocrine glands, and your systems eventually lose function instead of gaining it. The human nervous system is designed so that even critical functions such as breathing and heartbeat can run by themselves or be controlled voluntarily. Once the techniques of awareness and control have been mastered, amazing effects can be achieved. For example, there was an Indian adept named Swami Rama who displayed remarkable control over bodily functions that were thought to be totally automatic. In one instance, he caused the skin temperature on one side of his right hand to grow warmer while the other side became colder. The rate of change proceeded at about 4 degrees Fahrenheit per minute until one side of his hand was flushed red with warmth and the other was pale gray with cold. The total temperature difference was approximately 10 degrees. What power was being displayed there? In the Indian spiritual tradition, this is a branch of esoteric practice called Tantra, which teaches elaborate exercises for controlling involuntary responses. Tibetan Buddhism contains similar teachings. Young monks are expected to demonstrate their bodily control by such feats as sitting on a frozen lake and melting the ice around them with the warmth they generate in an intense meditational state. Native Americans, Sufis, and all shamanist cultures around the world contain such practices. Yet no matter how esoteric these exercises become, the power being called upon is not mystical. It is the same power of awareness that you use when you decide to switch from involuntary to voluntary breathing, blinking, balancing, or any other autonomic function. When you start to assert control over any bodily process, the effect is holistic. The mind-body system reacts to every single stimulus as a global event. In other words, to stimulate one cell is to stimulate all. There is a parallel in quantum terms, since a reaction anywhere in space-time, including past, present, and future, causes a shift in the entire quantum field. As one Nobel laureate put it, if you tickle the field here, it laughs over there. The fact that awareness behaves like a field is now deemed crucial to understanding aging. Healing is a conscious activity, and in order to reclaim your inner healer, you must go about it consciously. The task begins with simple awareness. Sit and be aware of yourself. If possible, do this right now. Let your attention go where it wants. Spend a minute or two at this right now. I'm sure you noticed that a minute of conscious attention seems like a long time. In addition, your mind probably went just not to one place in your body, but to several. And in between physical sensations, you were no doubt distracted by thoughts and emotions. These two are part of the healing process, because bodily signals naturally blend into and become part of mental signals. A hurt shoulder can remind you of a hurtful thought. It could also lead to reveries that help dispel the hurt. Anything is possible and anything works because it is all attention. But there is one thing especially that I'd like you to notice. So close your eyes again and without making a special effort, let the sensations come and go, seeing them as clouds passing across the sky. Don't stay with any one particular cloud. Just let your thoughts, feelings and sensations come and go as they will. Now, as you do this, see if you can become gently aware of the sky, the background against which these clouds are flowing. That is, gently notice the uninvolved witness, the seer who is observing all that is happening inside of you. You see, when you start watching your thoughts or your mind, then you become aware of yourself as not the mind, but the watcher. As you watch the mind, you become aware of yourself as the watcher. All right, pause the tape now, close your eyes, and practice this procedure if you're able to. The purpose of this exercise is to let you see, however briefly, that you are not your thoughts. You are the witness, the observer. As the clouds pass by, the sky is unchanged. As sensations pass through the mind, you are unchanged. Like a movie screen, your awareness gets constantly bombarded
with thousands of images, but that does not mean that you must be attached to those images. Is the screen attached to the movie? Of course, we all get caught. We all get attached because those images inside us are our movie. The drama affects us deeply. Even so, the healing mind is the part of yourself that does not get so involved. To understand this more fully, we need to explore the various layers of impulses as they come into the mind and get converted into the body. By doing this, we empower ourselves to heal ourselves and to live a life without limitations. The fact that you notice a thought does not mean you are watching it being born. Far from it. Thoughts are born deep in the unconscious mind, and the level at which you happen to notice them changes all the time. If you are absorbed in your work, you can ignore a headache for hours. If fear of failure is too threatening to be faced, you can suppress it for years. If you think that getting angry at those you love is wrong, you can convince yourself that you actually have no anger in you. Awareness can be endlessly manipulated because you have so much power over it. However, if inner intelligence is allowed to flow without being manipulated, it moves from subtle to gross. This means that every impulse begins in the silent depths of the mind, moves up through levels of thought, emotion, and feeling, and finally emerges as an expression on the physical level. Being alive, which we called a multidimensional act, is like a wave pulsing upward from the invisible to the visible, from a region the senses cannot register to one that they can. The closer you can get to that invisible source, the greater your healing power. What this translates into, in practical terms, is very simple. A quiet mind is all you need. By far, the most powerful way to discover the quiet mind is through meditation, using the process of transcending. Transcending is the mind's own way of unfolding to itself. Any value of inner silence is valuable. The deepest silence contains the most powerful form of awareness. As it is allowed to expand, silent awareness seeks out the old wounds and begins to mend them. The important principle here is that the subtler one's awareness, the more powerfully it can heal. Healing takes place when the mind and consciousness are silent. How does a fertilized ovum become a fully formed baby with all these organs and a heart and a brain and a liver and a skeleton? In the quietness of awareness. It's not thinking to itself, you know, should I make a liver, should I do this? And the mind is completely quiet. Nature functions through silent efficiency. This is called the principle of least action and maximum effectiveness. Look at it in nature. What do we see? We hardly see any effort. Do you see any effort in birds migrating from one part of the world to another? Or in the earth spinning on its own axis with the precision and accuracy that will confound any computer? Or the earth hurtling through outer space at thousands of miles an hour? Or the orchestration of the blooming of flowers with the onset of spring, and all the activity in nature, the government of nature, is silent, completely silent. And it involves the principle of least effort. Do less, accomplish more. Ultimately, do nothing, and you'll accomplish everything. The higher self is that place where everything is accomplished by doing nothing. A mere desire becomes the trigger for transformation. When the mind is silent and quiet, then inner energies wake up and work miracles on your behalf without any conscious effort on your part. Again, this brings us face to face with a cultural bias. We were all raised to believe that we have to work for what we want, that the harder we work, the greater the rewards. However, there are some things that require no work, and healing is one of them. You don't have to work to achieve a silent mind. You don't have to work to let your attention flow freely. You don't have to work to find the old wounds.
All these things are a given once they are uncovered. The uncovering begins wherever you are now, but its goal is always the same, the revelation of wholeness that unites body, mind, and spirit as one. When you close your eyes and go within, you cannot help but start where you are. The sensations that come to your mind are totally yours, totally unique. Perhaps you do not fully trust where you are going as your mind begins to unfold to itself, but trust builds up over time. Be easy with yourself, and the rest will unfold as it should. Once you start paying attention to your body and letting it express its needs, things will start to change. One has to be a little vague here because no two people are alike, and therefore the process of coming back into balance cannot be mapped out in advance. Realize that your body is a printout of extremely variable information. You're constantly projecting your old conditioning, your beliefs and self-images from the past. Through this filter comes your present awareness, your present thoughts, feelings and emotions in all their incredible variety. At deeper levels, your subconscious is trying to rid itself of old charged emotions while expressing other basic instincts. And since much of this material contains things you fear and dislike, your mind is constantly interpreting to itself, turning bad into good or at least tolerable. Some pain is so deep, however, that it cannot be faced at all. It goes into that vast no man's land of denial. Even so, your body is printing out everything, moment by moment. If all the bad things, the fears and old conditioning and all these suppressed instincts and denied emotions had the upper hand, you would have a hard time living a healthy moment. However, life is not predominantly fearful. It is intelligent, conscious, and full of joy. So is your body. Although islands of pain and discomfort exist in it, they are surrounded by an ocean of pure joy, of comfort, of bliss. When you trace any living impulse back to its source, this bliss is what you reach. We all live our lives from the top down. That is, we notice the grossest expression first. The outburst of anger, the bags under the eyes, the depressed mood. Only then do we undertake an investigation into the subtler causes for these problems, if we seek them at all. Nature works in reverse, from subtle to gross. To nature, your body is bliss first and foremost, a joyful creation whose intent is to live forever. Know that as yourself, and you will exist in a different world. As the ancient Indian sages proclaimed, from bliss these creatures emerged, in bliss they are sustained, into bliss they will merge again. This truth does not dawn all at once. There's a process of purifying the old conditioning that comes first. As each impurity is released, an overall transformation takes place. The body's intelligence regroups itself. It literally recreates itself around a new and purer image. All of us experience this whenever we recover from an illness. The moment comes when the feeling of being sick, accompanied by various symptoms, by fatigue and usually depression, and by a certain inertia in the mind and body, gives way to being well again. I'm a new person, you say, and you're right. Your body is printing out a new creation that is healthy instead of sick. As spiritual growth proceeds, these transformations take place every day. As inner intelligence flows to where it is needed, impurities are released in the form of old stresses. As they go, the entire printout changes. You automatically become integrated on a higher plane of functioning. On some days, you will feel surges of growth. Joyful moods begin to emerge. Former fears and inhibitions vanish, or at least partially melt away. Unexpected strengths seem to be in place. Most astonishing of all, you find that you know things that you never knew before. What you're really doing is tapping into your own informational fields and eavesdropping on
the cosmic computer, on the cosmic mind. See, people who are intuitive, they don't go out there to be intuitive. They go inside themselves. Because our bodies are focal points in a universal field of intelligence. So when we get in touch with that finest feeling, that finest level of feeling, that faintest emotion, that finest impulse of desire, we are tapping into an information field. We tap into that information field, we eavesdrop on the cosmic mind. This is the basis of intuition, of precognition, of knowledge that the seers arrived at even thousands of years ago, which is now being substantiated by modern science. I don't mean necessarily that this knowledge is in the form of technical information, although even that can happen. This knowledge comes in the form of insight. You begin to see what makes other people tick. Your own hidden motivations reveal themselves. Old fears appear in a new, less threatening light. The growth of insight tells you that purification is taking place, not just in the mind, but in every cell. There are times when this process of purification and integration is not so noticeable. People who consider themselves on the spiritual path can be shocked when they have a sudden outburst of anger. Contracting a serious illness can fill them with deep doubts. Such things aren't supposed to happen to spiritual people, and yet sometimes they do. Perfection is a real possibility for everyone, but the way to reach it is by letting go of imperfection. In that letting go, there are bumpy moments and major crises. They are crises of growth. All of us have different levels of trust in the process. Fortunately, the process builds trust as it goes forward by itself. We metabolize our experiences and we convert them into the body. You and I are different because we've walked through different gardens and knelt at different graves. Every little experience, every little wisp of experience that has come our way, we have metabolized it and made it into our body. And as we now go into higher states of awareness, we metabolize those experiences too. They also store the knowledge of higher realities, complete and formed, and they are ready for you to unfold them. Be easy with yourself and know that you are growing all the time. Your body knows how to purify itself. It contains everything you need to recreate yourself into a new being day by day. In truth, you have been doing that all along. Now the process has become conscious. So awareness is the key. You are repairing the leaks in your little boat, and soon it will be strong enough to carry you to the far shores of infinity.